uncharacteristically, I have a lot of material today. And I need you to bear with me. I'm going to go through this pretty quickly. If you're one who takes notes, don't even try it, because you're going to be two or three lines behind. I do have this boiled down into an outline or a condensation of the message, so all of the scriptural references are there, so if anyone wants a copy of this afterwards, it'll save you a lot of frantic writing. Today's message is going to continue in a way from the one I gave last time. Last time was the deep state, because the deep state is a component in world affairs. But this time I want to focus on the people. The people that are important to Bible prophecy. Where did those people come from? And where are they today? If you want a title is Origins and Dispersions, the Tribes of Israel and the World Today. The world of religion is often grossly ignorant. Sometimes we pick up on that ignorance. It can be hereditary, and in some cases it can be contagious. Things we don't think about. We just accept what is. We accept the common perceptions, the common opinions. One of which Cecil B. DeMille portrayed so accurately, the idea that the Israelites in Egypt were Jews. Actually, they had no idea what a Jew was back that far, and we'll see that. Another area where the world of religion is grossly ignorant is the source of the populations of the world, particularly Europe. Europe is important in the world. It's important in the end time, more important than we might realize. Logic is not employed often, even when things are obvious. You'll see that as we get through this material. Who are we, and how did we get here? Most of us are from a common ancestry. But do we have a clue who we descended from? Because it's important. It's more important than we might realize, especially as we get down towards the end time. All people on earth today have descended from one location on earth, a location in the mountains of Ararat, Noah's Ark. Your descent goes back to Noah's Ark. There are no other populations in existence today that did not descend from Noah and his three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Basically the white, the black, and the Oriental peoples. If you ever tried to trace your origins backward, you probably realize that it's pretty difficult. If you go back, say, 25 generations, that would take us back into about 1400 AD, you'd find that you have 33.5 million ancestors. It doubles in every generation. Every one of us has two parents, four grandparents, eight great-grandparents, and 16, and then 32, 64, 128. This is just in 256, just in eight generations. It gets pretty big pretty fast. And while our family tree is exploding, it explodes back into a period of time when the Earth's population was very small. So if you go back far enough, you'll find that you're related to just about everybody. Some people brag that they're related to kings. Yeah, We all are. Just a matter of which one and how far back you have to go. And then, of course, there's always the chance that you're descended from a pirate or a horse thief, too, just as, in fact, perhaps more likely than royalty. It's difficult to work it backwards. So let's turn it around and let's go from the other direction. Let's go back to the original populations and follow it forward. That's easier to do. And we have many historical references that will help us as we move along. Knowing the identities of the major players in end time prophecy is essential to understanding. Most church-going people are ignorant of who the nations are, of who the people are who are going to make up the events that we see prophesied. It's important that we have a general picture, at least in our minds, of who the peoples are. So let's go back and work from the things that we know. Because there's a lot of misconceptions out there. We hear the term Semite, or Hebrew, or Israelite, or Jew, or Gentile, or Saxon. These are words that factor into our histories quite a bit. But do we realize what each of those terms mean? What is a Gentile anyway? I learned from a little kid in Sunday school that a Gentile was anybody who wasn't a Jew. You're either a Jew or you're a Gentile. That's easy. Well, not entirely. That definition, being as narrow as it is, comes basically from Jewish exclusivism. That's the way a Jew would view it. You're one of us or you're not. So you're either a Jew, and if you're not a Jew, you're a Gentile. Seems to work. But let's test the premise a little bit. Was Abraham a Gentile? What about Isaac? Was he a Gentile? Was Jacob a Gentile? They weren't Jews. The children of Israel in Egypt were not Jews. They didn't have the Jewish religion. They didn't have any scripture. They didn't have a priesthood until well into the Exodus. They weren't Jews. They didn't act like Jews. So if they weren't Jews, were they Gentiles? No. Doesn't work that way. But from this side, in the modern day of modern ignorant time, we might tend to think that. The children of Israel didn't know the term Jew. It was invented some 700 years after the time of the Exodus. There were Gentiles at the time. There's a scriptural reference to Gentiles. It's in Genesis 10, I believe. Yeah, Genesis 10:5. This was a period of time not long after the flood. So there's a reference to Gentiles that far back. But the term Jew was centuries into the future. What makes the distinction? Well, something also we don't usually take into account is we, in our minds, tend to blend all of these historical events into a very narrow time frame, not realizing that no, they're spread over a long period of time. We tend to think that they happened in rapid succession when in fact they did not. We cite a Jew-Gentile distinction, but what were these Semites before there was any Jew? There's a reference to them being Hebrew, but what does that mean? Who was a Hebrew and who was not? Before there were Jews, they were Hebrews. But a much wider ethnicity than just Israelites. There are Hebrews that were not Israelites. So let's consider, what is a Semite? What is a Saxon? What is a Gentile? What is a Jew? And what is an Iberian or Eberian. That term shows up in many different ways. Genesis 43:32 mentions that the Egyptians wouldn't eat a meal with a Hebrew. So it shows that clear back to the time of Joseph in Egypt, there were Hebrew peoples there that were not of Joseph's lineage. They were a wider population in the world, so much so that the Egyptians had a thing against them. What were the other children of Israel, of Abraham called? Now we know that Israel was, of course, a descendant of Abraham, but Abraham had six other sons through his second wife after Sarah died. He married Keturah, and we can read of that in Genesis 25. What were the children of Israel before they were Jews? The question is, and what the point I'm getting to is the Jew-Gentile distinction the only categories of people that there are? What were the 10 tribes called during the 190 years of the United Kingdom in Israel? The 10 tribes all lived together as a united nation for 190 years. There was no Jew-Israelite distinction until the divided monarchy. All 10 tribes, even before the period of the kings, all 10 tribes coexisted together for some 460 years. The time from Saul to Jeroboam was about 190 years, from 1100 BC to 931 BC. We have terms that we use, and we don't always recognize what they mean. For example, Semite. During the Second World War, anti-Semitism was a very well-known phenomenon. We take anti-Semitism to mean Jews. No. Any person of the white race is a Semite. A Semite is a descendant of Shem, one of Noah's three sons. So the people persecuting the Jews were Semites themselves. Just they didn't realize it or didn't want to know. What is a Hebrew? A Hebrew is a descendant of Heber, Abraham's great-great-great-great-grandfather. There's a lot of people in the world who are of Hebrew descent who are not Jewish. They're not only Israelitish. There's a very broad ethnicity that are legitimately Hebrew, even though that isn't the term we commonly use. And as we saw in Genesis 10:5, Hebrews were known in Egypt before the time that Jacob and his entourage entered the land. Hebrews were known to be in Europe long before Israel was a nation. And that's an interesting consideration, because when the tribes migrated into Europe, their relatives, their distant relatives, were already there. Jews came into being years after the split with the northern kingdom. After the reign of Solomon, the kingdom split into two. There were the northern tribes and the southern tribes. The southern two and the northern ten. At some point after that, and it was years after, they went to war with one another. The northern kingdom fought the southern kingdom. And it was about that point in time where the southern kingdom became known as Jews. The first place that we see the word Jew used in the Bible, Israel is at war with the Jews. It's not a common term that far back. The first book of the Bible that uses Jew widely is the book of Esther. But it's a term that came into being much later in history than we would recognize. Then there are the Saxons. Who are the Saxons? Because we find that name all over the world, particularly in Europe. The Saxons were the descendants of Isaac. Isaac's sons. It seems obvious, but yet many people just don't accept that idea. But who were the Saxons? We have regions in Germany, in France, in southern England, of course the Anglo-Saxons, the Sakai of the ancient Asia Minor area. These were Saxons, and we'll see the names all over the region where they traveled and where they continue to exist today, as a matter of fact. The Saxons, in Latin, it's known as Saxonis. In German, it's Saxon, S-A-C-H-S-E-N. The Old English, it's Siax. Old Saxon, it's Sassen, S-A-H-S-O-N. Low German, it's Sassen, S-A-S-S-E-N. In Dutch, it's Saxon with a K. These were Germanic people whose name was given in the early Middle Ages, and that would be about 500 AD, to a large country, Old Saxony, near the North Sea coast of what is now Germany. These are the other descendants of the twins Jacob and Esau. Are they considered Gentiles? Why is one branch of Abraham's lineage Gentile while another is not? What makes the distinction? And we might ask the same of Jacob. Why is one branch of his family Gentile, or considered Gentile, and the other not? The 10 tribes could legitimately be considered, by modern definitions, as Gentile, if we simply base it on them not being Jews. But is the Jew-Gentile contrast the only ethnicity that there is? Are there other categories? Which is Israel? Israel is a family nation that came into being largely while in Egypt. They were just a family when they went in. They came out as a nation. 70 men, as it's listed in Exodus 1, verses 1 to 7. 70 men in some 2 centuries grew to some 2 to 3 millions. We know that from the fact that there were 600,000 men of war capability over 20 years old. So to host 600,000, there has to be close to 3 times that, maybe 4 times that, in the total population. The children of Israel in Egypt were not Jews. Their religion was not Jewish. They had no scripture, other than perhaps the book of Job. That's the only book that might precede the books of Moses. There was no priesthood. And the nation was named after Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel. We read of that in Genesis 48:16. Let my name be named on them. Israel enjoyed years of favor in Egypt out of the 215 years that they were there, Genesis 47:11. Oppression began after the death of Joseph, who was vizier to the Pharaoh, probably Sobekhotep VII, that we read of in Exodus 1:8. Oppression began under a Pharaoh who didn't know Joseph, Exodus 1:8. He was born... Yeah, Moses was born after the time of the famine. Joseph lived for some 70 years after Jacob and his 70 brethren entered. Genesis 50:22-26. The Exodus occurred 145 years after Joseph died. and some 430 years after the Abrahamic covenant was made that we read of in Exodus 12, verse 40. Egyptian bondage period lasted for some 85 to 90 years. Moses was about 80 years old at the time of the Exodus. So Moses was born somewhere in the time frame just after the bondage period or the oppression or the killing of the infants began. But then we come to the divided monarchy. We've now moved into the period of time after Israel has taken possession of the land. Did the kingdom of Israel become divided? Well, of course it did. 1 Kings 12 explains that. And here's something we don't emphasize, but perhaps we should. God ordained that split. And we can read of that in 1 Kings 12, verses 15 and 24. This was part of God's plan. We don't necessarily think of it as that, but there was a long-term plan being implemented that we don't necessarily think about, but that has everything to do with the development of the end time events. God wanted this to happen for His own reasons. Now, there was things that caused it, but still, God had it open for His own reasons. 1 Kings 12, verse 15. Wherefore the king hearkened not unto the people, for the cause was from the Lord. The cause was from the Lord, that he might perform his saying, which the Lord spoke by Ahijah the Shilomite unto Jeroboam the son of Nebat, down to verse 24. There was some thought from the southern kingdom to go to war to keep the nations together. Thus saith the Lord, you shall not go up, nor fight against your brethren, the children of Israel. Return every man to his house. They'd already mobilized. For this thing is from me. This thing is from me. God intended the nation to split because he had a long-term plan. They listened, therefore, to the word of the Lord and returned to depart according to the word of the Lord. There's a bigger picture taking place, and it has to do with these peoples. God has a plan. Did the individual tribes, after that point, either individually or collectively, ever war against one another? Judges 20 gives us an answer to that. What names did they use after the split? Neither one was a Jew at that point in time. Neither one was considered Jewish or went by the name Jew. They became known as the House of Israel and the House of Judah, or the Kingdom of Israel and the Kingdom of Judah. And they are shown to still be in existence at the second resurrection in Ezekiel 37. Did the northern kingdom become conquered and deported? We know that answer. 2 Kings chapters 17 and 18. What conquering nation took the kingdom of Israel away? And this is the point where we should probably start the presentation. I'm sorry, I skipped over that first one, so let's go right to number one. Slide one, yeah. The northern 10 tribes were taken captive by Assyria. And this is clear back in the 700s BC. And we can see that the Assyrian Empire was quite large. That darker green section up on the northern part is the basic Assyrian kingdom. And the lighter green is areas that they had conquered at their fullest extent. Where the Assyrians took the Israelites, was up into this region up around in here. The region between the Black and Caspian Seas. That's the Caspian Sea, that's the Black Sea. I don't know if you can read that. But this is where they settled, the people that they took out of the Northern Kingdom. Notice some of the names up there. We're going to come to those names later on. But you got Frisians, you got the Sumerians, and keep in mind the capital of Israel was Samaria. We've got, see if there's any other names that are, no. But the Caucasus Mountains are important too, and they are this range of mountains that span between the Black and Caspian Seas. They function somewhat as a barrier to migration early on. The kingdom of Assyria took the northern kingdoms captive. About a century after that, Assyria collapsed. They were taken over by the next empire, which is Babylon. Let's go to the next picture. Well, that's an enlargement of the last one. I might mention too the Scythians up here. That's a name to keep in mind. Because the Scythians were also, some of them, not all of them, were also Israelites. Now here's the Babylonian Empire. And you'll notice that Babylon basically takes over the same exact region as Assyria. It isn't like Assyria was one kingdom and then Babylon came along later on to just be an adjacent nation. They actually took over what had been Assyria. Assyria collapsed in about 612 BC, and you can see that the Babylonian Empire began about 625, less than a decade later. The capital of Babylon was here, the Babylonian Empire. The capital of Assyria was Nineveh. Let's go to the next image. Now, this is the interesting part. Because you'll notice that, except for the Middle East down in here, that Parthia occupied the same region as Assyria and Babylon. The Parthians came into existence about 250 BC and lasted for some 450, 500 years. And you'll notice their extent is up against the Caucasus Mountains between the Black and Caspian Seas. North of them is the Scythians. Parthia was a very powerful nation in its time. In the ancient world, it was given the rating of about the 10th most powerful nation in the ancient world. Sometimes the Scythians fought against Parthia. Sometimes they fought with Parthia, depending on what the threat was. The southern Scythians were of Israelite descent, and that's well documented in Stephen Collins' books, for example. The eastern Scythians, you see up here these Turkic tribes, they were a Hebrewish people, but they were not Israelitish. It's important to keep that distinction. Some Scythians were Israelitish, some were not. But Scythia and Parthia are important nations in the world. When you went to school, you probably never heard much about Parthia. I don't think I can recall ever hearing about it. But Parthia was a nation in its day, like I say, 250 years before and after, from B.C. to A.D., was a nation that rivaled Rome in power. Rome never conquered Parthia, though they tried. Parthia always defeated them. There was an occasional battle that might have gone Rome's way, but Rome was very afraid of Parthia because it was a rival power. Josephus identifies the 10 tribes in his day, and this would have been the first century, late first century, being located beyond the Euphrates. And the Euphrates River, of course, is right down and through here. And that's in Antiquities, Book 10, Chapter 9, Paragraph 7. And in his Book 11, Chapter 5, Paragraph 2, he says, "The 10 tribes are beyond the Euphrates are an immense multitude, inestimable in number." This is the same region where the kingdom of Israel was taken captive by Assyria. They're still there, hundreds of years later. Keep in mind, the 70 men going into Egypt some two centuries later grew to be some 2 to 3 million. How many Israelites of the northern 10 tribes were in Parthia and southern Scythia at the time? Well, then we come to the house of Judah. They also were taken captive. But they were taken captive in that period of time after Assyria had collapsed and Babylon had taken over their territory and their people. The house of Judah, or the kingdom of Judah, was taken over by Babylon. And this was some 135 years after the kingdom of Israel had been taken captive. I'm going to read something from the internet. Ashurbanipal was the last great Assyrian king after his reign of 42 years. The huge empire began to fall apart. It had become too large. Taxes were too high and the entire region rebelled. In 612 BC, Nineveh itself was razed by a host of Persians, Babylonians, and Medes. The great Assyrian empire was over. Babylon succeeded Assyria. Babylon assumed the territories formerly held by Assyria and the nation and its capital. This is where the southern kingdom, the kingdom of Judah, was taken captive to Babylon. And the Babylonians didn't do the same thing as the Assyrians did. The captives from Jerusalem were taken basically to Babylon. They didn't distribute them all over their region. They kept them in their home city. So there was a big difference. And the other difference is that the kingdom of Judah was allowed to return to their land after 70 years, where the kingdom of Israel never did return. What does that have to do with the Bible? If we go to Acts chapter 2, verses 9 to 11, this was a holy day season. In fact, this account relates to the day of Pentecost. But in Acts chapter 2, we see something that might just fly right by our radar, or right by our awareness, if we don't realize what we're reading. Because we see, beginning in verse 5, "And there were dwelling in Jerusalem Jews, devout men of every nation under heaven." Now it calls them Jews, and they were Jews religiously, but they weren't Jews ethnically. In verse 9, we see where these peoples had come from. First and foremost is the Parthians. You see, there was people even in the northern kingdom of Israel and their descendants who still regarded the Jerusalem religion as valid. They would travel all that way to Jerusalem for the high days. These people were there. Parthians, Medes, Elamites, Mesopotamians, Judeans, Cappadocians, Pontus, Asian, Frisians, Pamphylians, Egyptians, Libyans, Romans, Cretans, and Arabs. 7. We've got 8 nations here. Parthians, Medes, Elamites, Mesopotamians, Cappadocians, Pontus, Asians, and Frisians. At least these 8 were all from this region right up in here. We'll see some of those names on a later map. They were going to Jerusalem for the holy days. And at the holy days, this event happened, where the Holy Spirit spoke to all of those nations. One man was speaking, but all of them heard what he was saying in their own native language. What kind of a report do you think they took back home? They would have explained to their people that the Messiah is coming. He had just recently, within a couple of months, been resurrected. They prepared their own regions of the world for the coming of Christianity. And they're not the only ones who did. But think about the impact of that. The word would get out. Because these are the devout people of their nation anyway. So they prepared their homeland for what was to come during the apostolic era. But Acts 2 explains to us where many of the peoples of the house of Israel were at that time, confirming what Josephus says. Then there was another event some 30 years earlier, where some kings of the east came down into Jerusalem. We know of them as the Magi. Who were the Magi? We tend to disconnect them from any real national power. But the Magi were the intelligentsia. They were the ruling family, the ruling party of Parthia. The Parthian Empire existed from about 247 BC to 224 AD, about 470 years. Parthia was also known as the Arsacid Empire. In that name, Arsacid or Arsacid, we see the name Isaac. They named their capital city after Isaac. The Arsacids were the Parthian ruling class. The Parthian kings were known as Arsaces. The Parthian Empire, also known as the Arsacid Empire, became a world power in 247 BC. Arsaces I began its rise to dominance by conquering the northern region of Iran. At the time of its conquest, the province was in the rebellion against the Seleucids. Now keep in mind, the Seleucids were the northern kingdom that was at war with the southern kingdoms. It was the Seleucids against the Ptolemies. Those were the two, north, kingdom of the north, kingdom of the south, that we read of in Daniel chapter 11. The Arsacids superseded the Seleucids. They took control in that same region. But who were the Magi? Magi is a name short for Magistanes. Magi is the plural of Magus. You might recognize that name. The Magi were the astronomer priests. They were scientific and they were religious priests. A religious caste into which Zoroaster was born. Now the Zoroaster religion is going to be important. The Magi were Parthians who held the dual position of being priest-like as well as holding government office, which had an upper house of the Council of the Magistanes, from which we get the word magistrates. They were civil rulers with supposedly supernatural type wisdom and knowledge. One of their duties included the absolute choice and election of the king of the realm. Their kings were not necessarily hereditary. They were the controlling body. So these Magi came to Jerusalem looking for the king of the Jews. And they went to the man who thought he was king of the Jews. Get the picture here. A mere 34 years before that event, Parthia had conquered the Middle East, the Levant, the eastern end of the Mediterranean Sea. Parthia conquered that region from Rome a mere generation before. 34 years, that isn't that long a period of time. It would still be in people's memory. 34 years ago was the middle of the Reagan administration. I remember that clearly. They would have remembered when a nation came in and conquered their area away from the Romans and then turned around and left. That would have an impression. When these high-ranking representatives of Parthia came to Jerusalem looking for the king of the Jews, you can understand why Matthew 2:3 would say what it does. The whole city was in alarm. Matthew 2. Verse 3. Now when Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, I'm beginning in verse 1, in the days of Herod the king, behold, there came wise men from the east to Jerusalem, saying, where is he that is born king of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east, and are come to worship him. When Herod the king had heard these things, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. For all they knew, this was an advance party scouting out with the intent to conquer the area. Now they had to have a lot of, let's say, brass to go to the man who thought he was king of the Jews and ask him, where is the one born king of the Jews? Herod would think his throne was in danger. For that matter, his head. You can understand the alarm when you realize that Parthia had already invaded that area not long before and might likely be planning to do it again. Thus the alarm. That also tells us something, that people as far away as Parthia knew Christ's lineage, to know he was a legitimate heir to the Parthian throne. Now, Parthia had a problem. They had political problems, and there were a lot of assassinations. People who got to be king didn't live to be king very long. Others would assassinate them, hoping to get into power themselves, and before you know it, they didn't have very many legitimate heirs. But Jesus was a legitimate heir to the Parthian throne. That's why the Magi caused such a stir, because there was the potential of a major invasion. And their minds. Now, that wasn't really their intent. But what would the people think was the intent? And we can see in Matthew 9:27, 12:23, 15:22, and 21:9 that the general population knew Jesus' lineage. They knew that he was a descendant of David, which is going to be an important factor in later messages. The lineage of David, which Christ had said that there would never be a man not sitting on the throne of David throughout history. I'm moving too far ahead for that. But the general population knew Jesus' lineage, as did they. Why would they call him king of the Jews to the man who thought he was the king of the Jews? You can see what their concern was. The three gifts that they brought have a message in themselves. Gold, was a symbol of kingship on earth. Frankincense was an incense, a symbol of acceptance by the deity. And myrrh was an embalming oil as a symbol of death. What did they understand? They knew what was appropriate to bring. They could have brought jewels. They could have brought all kinds of... No, they brought the things that were appropriate to the prophetic message. There's a surprising Semitic Israel connection to David's royal household that exists in the royal Parthian ruling family. The Arsacid dynasty were Israelitish, descendants of Perez and King David. Israelitish tribes and clan names are found throughout the area they controlled. The capital city of Parthian Empire was named after Abraham's only son through Sarah, Isaac. They called their city Asak, A-S-A-A-K. The Romans referred to that city as Arsacia, which we can see similar to the name the Arsacids, who were the rulers. Rome battled this beyond the Euphrates power for dominance and supremacy in a series of conflicts. These conflicts ran from 66 BC to 217 AD, a span of 281 years. For a period of time, the power wielded by the Parthians so rivaled that of Rome that the Romans actually feared it. Rome invaded Parthia in 53 BC, and they were soundly defeated. General Marcus Crassus was killed with two-thirds of his 43,000-man army. Think that didn't scare Rome? Now, this was 53 BC. It was only about 11 years later. No, it was only about 19 years later that Parthia invaded the Middle East. The lands of Parthia and Scythia became the ruling entity after the 3rd century BC. We might ask, what was the northern kingdom's religious preference? Remember, they had abandoned the religion of the Bible, the religion of Moses, for something else. Well, old Persian texts predating the Hellenistic period refer to a magus as primarily a Zoroastrian priest. Zoroastrianism was a principal religion among the tribes adopted after being relocated there by Assyria. Zoroastrianism is one of the oldest monotheistic religions, founded in Persia about 1500 BC, was popular in the ancient world. Now, we tend to think of them, or any other religion like that, as being pagan. No, they rejected paganism and animal sacrifices. Their supreme god was Ahura Mazda, akin to Mithraism. And I spoke on the Mithraic religion back in about August of 07. I didn't think it was that far back, but the Mithraic religion was very similar to Zoroastrianism. They taught of doctrine of a single god. They taught against over-ritualistic ceremonies. They believed in evil spirits and also the existence of a Satan, which the Sadducees, the priests in Jerusalem area, did not, as we can read that of Acts 23, verse 8. Here's something important. Many Zoroastrians left India and Iran. Now keep those two regions in mind. India and Iran. To settle elsewhere, mainly in the Western countries. The European languages, including English, is regarded as Indo-Iranian. Now, I heard that as a kid in grade school, and I thought it strange that the English language would come from that region of the world. But it's the very region where the northern kingdom of Israel was taken captive. When Zoroastrians migrated west, and the only direction west would be into Europe, they created a fertile ground for the acceptance of Christianity. By the time it got there, it was Catholicism, but they paved the way for the acceptance of the Christian teachings. Where are such nations today? Where are the nations that are primarily Protestant Catholic, so-called Christian? Where are they? They're basically centered in Europe. There are other nations that accept Christianity, or peoples who do, but not necessarily whole nations. Those nations that accept Christianity in its various forms are primarily those nations that have descended from the European stock. As the Parthian Empire began to lose its power, and this was sometime after the 300s AD, they crossed the Caucasus Mountains, this range of mountains right here. And they went north and then west, just like the prophecies say. That was the direction that God prophesied that they would go. It was part of His plan. And in so doing, they took on a name for themselves that we call ourselves today. If you ever filled out any kind of application form, they ask you what your gender is. That's usually pretty easy. And they ask you your race. And we have to check the box, Caucasian. Why? Where in the world did that name come from? It's an admission of the fact that people know, but they don't want to say, they don't want to admit, that our ancestry came from that region of the world, Indo-Iranian, the Caucasian region. That's why our language is Indo-Iranian. I could go on, there's many more details, but I think that's sufficient to give the picture that Israel, the nation of Israel, the northern kingdom, was taken out of the land for good reason, yes, in accordance with God's will, were brought into nationhood in that region of the world, and we could perhaps go to the next slide at this point, and they migrated northward and then eastward. I'm sorry, westward, northern and westward. Now notice, there's a tribe here called the Iberians. Who are the Iberians? This is the Iberian Peninsula. This is Hibernia. All of those carry the name of Eber. They're Hebrew peoples. And this is in 500 BC, already there. So they were the precursors for the Israelite tribes when they went north and then west. The Saxons originally were known to exist about in this area right in here. And then, of course, they spread out into all of Europe. From Western Russia all the way down to Spain, those peoples are largely the descendants of the 10 tribes of Israel. People don't know that today. They don't seem to care. But it's important to understanding what's happening in the world. In Daniel chapter 12, in the concluding passages, it says, this is verse 4, "But you, O Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book even to the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased." Passage we know very well. Down to verses 9 and 10. "And he said, Go your way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end. Many shall be purified and made white and tried. But the wicked shall do wickedly like they always do, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand." Understand what? prophecy. The book of Daniel is about prophecy. To understand, we have to have an awareness of who the players are and what's developing. God has many end-time prophecies and will never put the picture together that well until and unless we know who the peoples are that he's talking about. We can't expect a scholar of 200 years ago or 100 years ago or even 50 years ago to have to know specifically how these prophecies are going to work out and who it's going to involve. We today can see things developing that were not necessarily what we expected a generation ago. And of course, to be wise in this period of time, it has to be someone who's alive. So the end time living generation are the people that are being referred to where it says, the wise shall understand. And what does he mean, wise? It's not talking about conversion, because there are many people through history who have been converted who are not being referred to. It has nothing to do with conversion or salvation. It has to do with the time. People converted in past ages are just as converted as anyone, perhaps more so in some cases. Being wise at this time is an additional overlay to our conversion. God wants his people to know what's happening when it's happening. And knowing the peoples that he is working with, that he is using, that he is causing to fulfill his plan, is important for those of us living in the last generation. Hopefully that's us. More next time.